Hey there, friends. Jay Rebel here. Welcome to another edition of Mid-Am Crisis. I sure am glad to have you listening in as always, and I think you're going to really like today's episode. I had the opportunity to have a wonderful conversation with one of the great artists operating in the golf world today. His name is Lee Wybranski. If you are a fan of merchandise tents at golf major championships, you're probably going to be pretty familiar with Lee's work. His posters that are based off his paintings that are inspired by the courses that are hosting these major championships are always very hot items in the merch tent, and they have become a fairly essential part of the identity of every major championship that falls on the calendar. This year, this last 7 or 8 months, obviously we've had quite a few major championships, so Lee has been very busy. And on the back end of this, super major season, I had this chance to have a conversation with him. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. Lee is just a wonderful guy, really creative, someone who obviously loves the game with a fervent passion. To have the opportunity to look beyond just those posters that we're familiar with and understand his process, understand what drives him, and understand what it's like for him traversing the country and working with these great championships and the courses that host them was a real treat. Beyond those major championship posters, he also does a ton of art and design work for clubs and courses all over the spectrum of golf. I mean, we're talking some of the country's most elite private clubs. We're talking, show-stopping, jaw-dropping resort courses and all the way down to municipal facilities. So he's well-rounded on that front. Lee lives out in Flagstaff, Arizona, so we talked a lot about life out there. And we also traced back through his career. He was born and raised in Philadelphia, which obviously has a rich golf history, and that still inspires him today. So he was kind enough to treat me to, again, an entire conversation about how his career came about, where it stands today. We dove into the state of the golf world and the golf business and how the COVID boom may continue to impact that for years to come. It was a wonderful conversation. I really think you're going to like it. I know that I consider it a wonderful chance anytime you meet a kindred spirit in the game of golf, and I think Lee and I would both agree that our love for the game is probably pretty similar on a lot of fronts, and I imagine that is probably true for you too. So, before we jump into my conversation with Lee, I do want to give a little shout out and a nod to my friends at Imagine Golf. They make this show possible with their patronage, and I certainly appreciate that. I hope if you have been listening to the show for a while, you have gone out and downloaded the Imagine Golf app. If you haven't yet, I would greatly encourage you to check that out. Imagine Golf provides subscribers and listeners these incredible daily audio lessons. They're short. They're 3 minutes a day. Imagine improving your thinking on the golf course in just 3 minutes a day. I have become such a big fan of it. In fact, last week, I shot my best round of the year. I made a birdie putt on the last hole. My confidence is starting to brim again just in time for another kid to be born in our family. But I shot 71. It's the lowest round of the year, and I truly credit it to those daily lessons on Imagine Golf, because guess what? I don't really have much time to practice. So my practice these days is when I'm walking the dog or on the way to work, listening to these three-minute lessons from some of the great wise thinkers in the game of golf, and I can't tell you how much I enjoy it. So get out there, support our friends at Imagine Golf, download the app, and I think you're going to see that your game will improve if you do so. Put those 3 minutes in each day. So that being said, I am ready to turn it over to my conversation with Lee Wybranski, one of the most talented artists in the game of golf today, and someone that if you're not following him, I hope you will. So enjoy this conversation with Lee, and we'll see you out there on the course somewhere. Lee.
Hiya, Jay.
How you doing, man?
Man, I'm doing great, thanks. How about you?
I'm doing well, doing well.
Glad to hear that.
How are things in Arizona today?
Man, they are wet and stormy, just the way we like them this time of year. You might hear the occasional rumble as we chat. We're in the middle of the afternoon monsoon. It's coming down cats and dogs, but, keeps the golf courses green out here. So we love the rain.
Yeah, that water's going to go downhill somewhere and hopefully to a golf course, right?
Yeah, right. That would be nice. It's there's been some flooding up here, which has made some national
Really?
news. But fortunately for us, that's on the other side of town. Yeah, we certainly need the rain here. I understand it's that time of year for you too.
Yeah, Florida just really lives up to its swampy reputation about the middle of July. So we're in the middle of that. It's between punched greens and overcast afternoons. It gets a little hard to get out there this time of year, but yeah, we'll be back in the full swing up here for too long.
I was just in your lovely state playing some wonderful golf. It was quite damp, but I was we're doing a project with Tim Aquana over in
Oh.
Jacksonville, a centennial art project for their upcoming 100th anniversary. And I was out there for a few days about 2 weeks ago.
That
And
is
yeah,
fantastic.
it was hot and humid, and the course was soft, but managed to get all 18 in and still get some pictures taken. It wasn't so bad.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I've had the pleasure to go over there quite a bit. I've got friends that are members there, and that's a real treat, man. They've done an outstanding job, really bringing that course up quite a few notches in recent years. Their superintendent, Alan Brown, and just the whole team there is just knocking it out of the park. Got Jim Furyk Senior Tour event coming up soon. Some
Yeah,
USGA
maybe headed
stuff.
down there for that. As I mentioned, the weather when I was there was not photogenic, so I thought it might be worthwhile. I have another trip to the southeast coming in the fall, and I thought I might try and time it around Jim and friends.
Yeah, Jim and friends, right? Yeah, well, it's just a great place to be, especially like in that kind of late winter, early spring, getting the fall when it's crispy out. It's a great walking golf course. Place is dead flat.
Amazing. It is a lovely, lovely walk for sure. And it's so classic. The
It really
clubhouse
is.
setting is really one of the most impressive and natural, and everything's just right where it ought to be.
Yeah,
It's really something else.
that place flies below the radar too. I mean, it really doesn't ping on any of the, top this and that list. But I got a feeling that's going to continue to change. And they're getting ready to shut the whole place down after the Furyk tournament and rip it up and get
Right.
it looking
Yeah.
even better.
Bruce Hepner going in there to work a little more magic. He's done the bunkers already and going to be doing a little more over there. And yeah, it's everything you say. It's an understated gem. I feel like a lot, I'm from the Northeast where there's, plenty of topsy-turvy golf courses. And I feel like those flattish lowland kind of golf courses are they're just a really different genre. And they really, I feel like, require in a way a lot more work by the designer to create interest and challenge on a relatively, flattish piece of ground. And I always enjoy there's a lot of subtlety to those kind of courses. And Tim Aquana is all about that. I mean, boy, I happen to play, the day I happen to play, I got some lessons recently for our mutual friend Tom Coyne's event. I didn't want to go out there digging ditches, so I tried to sharpen up my game this spring a little. So I was actually playing tee to green pretty well out of Tim Aquana, but man, I must have three putted six times. Those greens, there's just not a flat
Yeah.
look on them.
No, you can really do it. And they're all elevated off your point about the, terrain out there. Those complexes just are really, really interesting with a lot of cool movement. And you start missing on those edges a little bit. There's a very much a kinship there, or family relation to some things you'll see at Pinehurst, for those who've maybe never been. But it's a wonderful track, great routing. Some great par threes out there that
Oh
all over
my.
the play.
In fact, I think in the artwork, I'm going to strongly. So for these types of projects, what we do or what I do is what we call a golf course routing, which is typically a very large painting, like let's say 3 by 5 feet, something like that. And the central portion of the painting is an accurately painted aerial view of the golf course, essentially a decorative map inspired by centuries of cool cartography, which has sort of informed my work. In addition to the drawings of the great old classic architects who could each render golf holes in their sort of unique idiosyncratic ways. So the center portion of the painting is always the map of the layout. And then I typically sort of intersperse little vignettes from the ground around the map. to fill out the composition and sort of flesh out the story of the place. You know, these types of projects are intended to capture the whole spirit and essence of a place as much as possible. So in the case of some clubs, I've done one long, wide panoramic vista across the bottom of the picture. And in other cases, I've done 8 or 9 portraits of prominent golfers who have been associated with the club through the years. In the case of Tim Aquana, however, which prompts this digression, I'm thinking we're going to put the 4 par 3s in the corner of the picture because yeah. The par threes there are just fantastic and really unique and varied and just a really strong component of the course. So I kind of wanted to, none of that's set in stone, but that was one of my sort of top of my head ideas when I walked off property after a couple of days.
Yeah, put the 4 beautiful par threes in there and then maybe slip you a tomahawk, you know, cocktail that they like to serve in that turn house and you'll have it all dialed in, man.
Yeah, right. Fortunately, the turn house was closed when I was there.
So I'm sorry to hear that.
I have more accurate notes.
Yeah, well, that's just all the more reason for the return trip.
There you go.
Yeah, that's a great little spot there. And if you ever get a chance to get that cocktail, I would highly recommend it. All my Tim Aquana friends that'll hear this will certainly lighten up knowing that you're working with the club. That's really cool. Talking about your process a little bit, you've got such a range of things that you work on. I think a lot of people probably know your work from some of the pronounced major championship renderings that you do every year in partnership with those either venues or entities that are putting on those events. When you come into something like that, where's your creative process begin when you start to flush out what you're going to put on the canvas?
Well, we do so many different kinds of work visually in the studio, from logo design and branding, to the event posters that you mentioned, to the fine art commissions. But the thread that I feel like connects all these different hats that I wear, that we wear at the studio, is visual communication. So I'm really, I view our projects always as collaborative enterprises. I try and soak up and absorb and observe as much culture, history, anecdote as possible from each venue. Essentially, you try and, as a writer, you might find parallels. I feel like I really start the process by trying to first gather grist for the mill, which I bring back to the studio. And then I distill that down into what I think are the key elements that have some sort of a pictorial opportunity associated with them at the club. So in the case of a logo, maybe there's a, I'm trying to think of, some interesting stories. So we just rebranded Weeburn Country Club in Darien, Connecticut, 125-year-old club, founded by a friend of Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie named the course, and he named it Weeburn because originally the course was a modest 9 holes set out along a small stream in Darien, Connecticut. So for our branding there, we took our inspiration from the origin story, and the branding is based on a sort of stylized rendition of this Weeburn with a golf flag. So there we kind of, started just the same way. We looked at a lot of different stories, a lot of different facts, a lot of different local landmarks, trying to find out what resonates the most. Essentially, what's the most important thing to put across? So in the case of that logo, we decided that the origin story was really the most appropriate thing to put out there, but we put it out there in a way that speaks to the next 100 years, not to 100 years ago. Yeah. In the case of an event poster, same job, trying to establish what the message is. But as we sort of veer more from design and into art and illustration, I take greater liberties and I exert more influence on it because the scope of the project is more creative. And that's obviously, one of my areas of expertise. So in the case of an event poster, typically what I'll do, like I'll cite one of our most popular posters was the 2015 Chambers Bay U.S. Open poster.
Yeah, I remember
that. Which was interesting to me because it's not a classic golf course. I mean, it's a relatively new golf course built by a prominent designer. RTJ2 built it. It's a public course. anyways, as a big devotee of the mythical and all the magical history of golf, like, you know, the U.S. Open, I generally, like most people, you associate places like Shinnecock and Oakmont and Pinehurst. So it was interesting to me that this poster and this Open was as successful as it was. But to the point, when I go to a place like Chambers Bay, it's an open canvas. You know, there's no specific, there's no specific thing that everybody knows yet, because it's a new venue. And so I get to really roam far and wide and let my imagination go a little bit. But that's overstating it a bit because I'm fairly methodical. So my first day at Chambers Bay, I cover every nook and cranny of the golf course with a camera and a sketchbook. I snap anything that's even remotely interesting just to like get it into the mix, you know? But typically by the end of that first day, I have established probably 2, 3, 4 maybe different views that I think have potential. But almost always there's one that's head and shoulders my favorite. And the reason it rises to the top is because what I do is I identify what I think are the 3 or 4 key players in the story. You know, I literally think of it as a movie almost. Usually there's a lead and there's 2 or 3 supporting actors. And I try and sort of remove all the extraneous stuff and let those 3 to 4 principal elements really stand out. And that's, I think, what contributes to the iconic feeling that I try to create in the event posters. So at Chambers Bay, you know, the golf course is nifty. It's one of those courses that I thought, much like Erin Hills, like similar kind of vibe, similar, genre again, newish course, not a lot of history, but literally you get on the golf course there, it makes you want to get your clubs out of the trunk and go and find the first tee. I mean, it just looks like so much fun visually to play. So I've played Chambers a few times. I've enjoyed the heck out of it. But when I first got on the golf course with the camera, the first thing after looking around extensively, the bunkering there is just really gnarly, very visually intimidating, ubiquitous, ranging in scale from the little pot bunkers to massive cavernous blowout bunkers, you know? So I thought the bunkering was very strong. And in terms of the golf course itself, I thought it was sort of the most intriguing and dramatic and attractive feature of the golf course, which is not unusual. Bunkering is kind of like, you know, the eyes of the portrait, so to speak. You know, it's often some of the most interesting parts of a golf course are how it's bunkered. So at Chambers Bay, we had that. And then, sorry, I should probably be letting you talk in between.
I'm here to listen to your side of the story.
It's fun, this stuff. That was one of my most sort of successful, adventurous days because I really feel like I discovered it. You know, I discovered and found the view I was looking for. So I established these things. The bunkering was very prominent. That was important. Obviously, the water was important. I mean, it's right on the Puget Sound, so you can't not have the water in the picture. The train, I mean, is there anything more romantic as a visual or literary element than a train?
No.
So that was an obvious thing. So then that sort of narrowed, right, because of the geography, that narrowed my choices considerably. You know, I wanted to have views of the water, views of the train, and hopefully interesting views of like a well-bunkered golf hole. And then that kind of leaves out even like the Olympic Mountains, which were a little bit out of the frame, but I took artistic license and pulled them into the frame.
Yeah.
And then there's the bridge that goes over to Gig Harbor. I don't recall the name of the bridge, but there's a cute little bridge that connects Gig Harbor to the mainland. So I brought that in on the other side. And so in that case, there were probably 5 characters, but the last 2 weren't that important. But once I establish these different things, I go looking for a composition on the ground that includes all of these features in a view that hopefully feels harmonious, natural, and unforced, you know? So that's really what I try and get to as a finishing point. And that was one of the most successful efforts because I really felt, you kind of feel like a detective out there a little bit, trying to first look for the clues and then, you know, and then find like the scene of the crime where all the clues are all together.
Yeah, well, and you know, to me, the real most amazing thing about any piece of art that's got a lot of interesting details like that is how the artist then weaves them into something cohesive. And I think you do that incredibly well. I like the way you frame that kind of almost like a movie poster. I never really had thought about your work in that regard. But now that I hear that, I'm like, well, that's exactly what it is. I mean, and it really does. You can almost hear the trailer voice, you know, start to tell you what you're going to be in for, this summer. On this Puget Sound. That's cool, man. So, my next question is always when I hear someone that really is passionate about what they're doing, and it comes off so clearly with you, is how did that passion develop in your life? How did you get into a place where you're roaming around on golf courses looking for those details to weave mm-hmm. together?
You know, it's not the most obvious or expected avenue, I guess, which is typical in life. You would think that I grew up loving the game and all that. I really didn't. I caddied once at 13 for a few weeks, and I've always been skinny and nearsighted, so I was a terrible caddy. And, this was back in the 80s when, the golf bags were like Lazy Boy chairs. Mm-hmm. So I just went back to mowing lawns for a dollar back then. I had an aunt and uncle who played. We lived kind of in the outreach suburbs outside of Philadelphia. So some of my family had a little bit of land, and on 4th of July picnics or whatever, I had an aunt and uncle who would be out there pitching nine irons, back and forth across the field. And I would try that now and then, but essentially it was the art that led me to the game rather than the other way around. A story I tell in some interviews, the dean of the Visual and Performing Arts School, where I went to college, Syracuse University. The opening orientation for our, sub-school, the artists, he says, less than 2 years after you graduate, or in 2 years after you graduate, less than 15% of you will be working in the arts. And I found that so abrasive and offensive that he would lead with that. But in the years that have passed, I felt like what he did was very deliberate. And, I think he really threw down the gauntlet to separate people who are going to pursue this with zeal and passion and those who aren't, because it's a hard road as an artist in general. I mean, there's lots of different roads, some more commercial, some less so. But it's not like a job that you really get into necessarily to make money. You get into because you love doing it and you want to find a way to do it. So when I heard that quote, I thought, well, I'm damn well going to be one of those people who's making a living making pictures somehow or another. And I didn't ever have a really strong sense of where or how I was going to find a path. I just knew I wanted to make pictures and find a way to make a living making pictures. So one thing led to another, and I discovered a sort of an entrepreneurial side of myself that I didn't know I had. Essentially, after school, I'd stumbled into this opportunity doing architectural renderings, these very traditional renderings of homes and estates on the main line outside of Philadelphia. And I did that for a year or two. And then my partners and I at the time, we thought, well, where can we take this and grow it, because that's sort of a one and done kind of a model, and we wanted to find a place where people would be interested in purchasing copies and reproductions of these original paintings, because, you put your heart and soul into something, even if it's something like that. I've always been someone who jumps in with both feet, even if it was a picture of, 100-year-old mansion in Chestnut Hill, I wanted to make it, as dramatic and interesting and rewarding to the viewer as I could. So I put a lot into it. And when you put a lot into something as an artist, and I'm sure you can relate to, I don't know, I want to assume, but I feel like you want people to see it, Oh, yeah. That's the vanity of being a creative person to me is, when you put your efforts into something, you want eyes on it. I wanted more people to see my work than, sort of this narrow audience that I was serving in that. So we started showing the portfolio to some top clubs around the New York Met section. I'm from Philly originally, so that was a skip and a jump. And we thought basically that it would be the best clubs in the world that would be interested in commissioning artwork. It's not a kind of a thing you'd bring to a second tier club or a muni or something. So we started showing it around New York. Winged Foot was my very first commission, a drawing of their famous Clifford Wendehack clubhouse. Colin Burns was our first client, still the general manager at Winged Foot, whom we just worked with extensively around the US Open last year. That was a full circle moment for me, coming back to Wingfoot after starting my whole career there in golf. But that's how I got into golf, really. I mean, Wingfoot, as you would expect, opened a number of doors within that community immediately. So shortly thereafter, I had done pictures for Saucon Valley, Caves Valley, Ridgewood, Salem up in Massachusetts, National Golf Links, Atlantic Golf Club. So within 6 months or so, I was suddenly a golf artist. And and from there, I just sort of tried to expand, you know, expand the arsenal or expand the range of what we can do and offer to that community. I was a competitive pool player when I kind of got into golf. So I felt like it was a very easy transit. I started to play in my mid-20s once I started to work in golf. In fact, that's kind of a funny story. I come from a big, big family, and we were at Thanksgiving, and one of my uncles, not the one I mentioned earlier, but another of my uncles is a golf, you know, maniac who's, you know, I mean, he's had the same banana slice for, you know, my entire life. I don't know. I don't know how he still plays so much, considering if I didn't get better after 40 years, I mean, I might hang it up.
But he must know how to work it.
Oh, he loves it. He does it. He can play those left or right holes like nobody's business.
Yeah.
So anyways, I told him that I had an invitation to play Wingfoot, and he asked me if I was going. When I was going, I said, well, I'm not going. I don't really know how to play golf. I'm not going to play a famous course like that and then go out there and dig holes. And he's like, man, are you crazy? I'll go. I'll tell him I'm you. So he kind of put the idea in my head, like, you know, I might be missing out on something here. So I didn't want to miss out on any perks. But more importantly, really, I thought it would inform the work if I played it and liked it. And I gave it a try, and I got bit by the bug like a lot of us do. And it was a time in my life, you know, I was single. I loved to practice. I just, you know, my main favorite thing would be going down to the Muni, down by I-95, you know, next to the airport, and hitting balls and chipping and putting in the evening hours. And, you know, next thing you know, I love the game probably as much as anybody out there. And I read all the literature. You know, as someone working in the game, I felt like it was imperative, really, to sort of learn as much about it as I can. I mean, that's sort of my personality as an artist, I think, as well. But I very much like soaking as much up as I can. So I read, you know, everything from the old classics, you know, Bernard Darwin to Tom Doak's Confidential Guide and everything in between. And I looked at all the artwork. There's a lot more great literature than artwork around golf, but there is some great art to look at. And I just sort of grazed as broadly as I could during the first 10 years to really educate myself around golf course design, the history of golf in America, the history of golf as a game. And there I was traveling to these amazing places, you know, reading all that and then going to Baltusrol to do a painting and looking at all the artifacts on display and you know, reading about, you know, Jones there, you know, the full range of history that's occurred at any number of these amazing courses around the country.
Well, and I have to imagine, yeah, I know it does for me, you know, when trying to write something, but, you know, to have that foundational knowledge of the history of the game and that understanding of where the game has come from, where it's going, and then to add on top of that, you know, some playing ability, it just opens up, you know, the radar dramatically to the things that are, you know, start to land on your, you know, into your peripheral view. You know, when you're out there mm-hmm. walking around the golf course, all of a sudden you just see things that,
right,
that most wouldn't pick up on. And it's those are the little details to me that, you know, when I look at some of your work, you know, now that I've heard you tell that story too, it just, you can tell that you're looking, you know, with a very wide view, open to whatever might be on the ground at any of these places. And so, you know, from the playing perspective, you know, what are some ways that has transformed your art since you've really gotten into the game?
I would say the most visceral way that it's informed my work is just through increased passion. Mm-hmm. I feel like, if you love to play, it's just more exciting to me than it would be if I wasn't a golfer. You know, I mean, I've always been drawn to the sports that I like to play as a fan. I mean, mm-hmm. I'll watch football, don't get me wrong, but you know, growing up, I played soccer, I played tennis. So, you know, I was that, you know, nerdy kid who was waking up early to watch Wimbledon when I was 13, you know, because I love that kind of thing. So I was always drawn to the sports that I like to play. So golfing for me, it just fuels the fire, you know, or it throws coals on. It just keeps me interested, keeps me inspired. I love where the game is at right now in terms of this return to sort of, you know, mostly a more minimalist design aesthetic. Although there's some cool artists or, you know, golf course designers who are doing things that aren't necessarily traditional or minimalist, but they're handmade. And I feel like that's one of the things that I respond to the most. I mean, when I'm out there on the golf course, you know, I always sing the praises of the superintendents and the golf course designers, because a lot of times what I think that I'm doing is really I'm making art about art. You know, I'm not making a landscape of some virgin forest. I'm out there painting a picture of an environment that's been crafted deliberately. And when you go to courses that are really well done, everything's in just the right place. I mean, there's a million paintings out there just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even take a whole bunch. I mean, it takes some ability to paint them, but it doesn't take that much ability to see it, to know it when you see it. Like, wow, you know, every golfer, there's a visual component to our sport, our game, that's unique, I think. And, you know, traversing a landscape as you play a game, it is a journey and it has its own sights. And if you're a golfer like I am, meaning a mid-handicap golfer, you find nooks and crannies of the golf course that, you know, aren't always the most pleasant to play out of, but are often, like, you know, afford some interesting views.
Yeah. You know, I've had people ask me, maybe that are at a different stage of their golf addiction. You know, I've always been hooked on the game since I was, you know, kind of knee high to a grasshopper, but nice. It really wasn't until my late 20s that I started, you know, like you were saying, reading all the classic books and understanding architecture and really just diving into, you know, those finer points of the game. And it really just opens your eyes to so much more. It makes the game so much bigger. And nowadays when I meet people who maybe are just kind of starting down that rabbit hole, you know, you might get asked a question like, in your mind, what makes a golf course, or what's the difference between a good golf course and a great golf course? And I always think about a perspective from Mike Strantz, and I was doing some reporting about his life. You know, he talked about designing a golf course in full, 360 degrees of design. And he was a trained artist. And, you know, when I remember back when I took, you know, art classes when I was in high school, you know, you know, my instructor would talk about, you know, filling the canvas up, right? Don't leave anything open on the canvas, you know, make sure that it's painted in full. And so when I was doing that research and I'm playing his golf courses, he talked about, no matter where you are on the golf course, you ought to be able to look around you in any direction. To your point about, you know, if you're a mid high handicapper and you're off in a different angle, it still should look beautiful from that right. angle too. And so to me, the thing that separates the good from the great is that, you know, the fullness of the design, not that, you know, you can play a good golf course that's got, you know, a little corridor and it's got golf on it. But if you get too far off the corridor on the other side of the green, or looking back across, you know, different parts of the property, you can see the seams. And, you know, to me, the greatest place are those ones where no matter where you are on the property, you can look around and there are no seams. It's just landscape designed in full, you know?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that that's another, speaking to sort of the trends and evolution of course design over the last 30 years, you know, in the 90s, the highest compliment you could pay a golf course was you couldn't see any other holes from the hole except the one you were playing. And I mean, I couldn't be further from that. It's great. Social media has created a lot of this opportunity too, but there's so much community now around the game. And there's a renewed emphasis on the human connections that occur on the golf course being like among the most important qualities of the game. And I feel like when you're playing, you know, all the deforestation that's been going on since Oakmont's first lightning storm 20 years ago, you know, you get to see all these little dramas unfolding around you. And, you know, artistically, I always love to try to afford peaks and little windows in a picture where you can see those, I mean, that's Renaissance stuff to me. You know, if you look at even the Mona Lisa, there's subtle little things going on in the background there. I mean, obviously you're looking at her, but there's other things happening. And I always feel like that's the human condition. And, you know, there's so many metaphors about golf and life, but, you know, there's all sorts of dramas unfolding on those, you know, 100 acres at the same time. And it's fun to be able to sort of offer a glimpse of more than one.
Yeah, if that was just a lady with a smirk and no background, I'm not sure that painting has the same depth. The you know, it's funny, a great thing you mentioned there too. You talk about the internet, you talk about the depth of the game today, you talk about community in the game today. I always like, you know, that expression, I'd rather be lucky than good, but damn thing bad being both. And so, you know, you think about your career and the arc there, you know, what a time for anyone trying to make a career creatively through golf to be doing it, because it does seem that there is a huge awakening in the game right now. You know, there are more windows for people to, you know, peer around and kind of go, oh wow, there's a whole lot more here than I ever realized. And you can sense it growing. You can sense the conversation getting larger, and the number of people, again, who are just getting increasingly exposed to that depth that we're talking about. And I have to imagine that's just been like rocket fuel for the career path you've been on.
It's been very, very helpful. And, you know, the timing has been fortuitous. I mean, essentially, I mean, I don't know, in every aspect of life, things change faster than ever, right? But I do feel like a bit of a bridge between two different eras. You know, when I started working in golf, the internet was barely alive. But I also started working in golf when Tiger Woods arrived. Yeah. So Tiger's emergence and ascendance literally was the rocket that we rode for the first 20 years. You know, it just created a compelling atmosphere and a compelling, you know, and golf was like suddenly something that everyone wanted to watch when Tiger was, you know, at his very best. And so that came along, and then obviously that's, you know, faded as age, you know, humbles all of us. But now I feel like, more to your question, you know, as Tiger is sort of, you know, moved on in his career, et cetera, social media and this social media, I don't know how they all connect. To me, it's a tapestry, you know, and yeah, it's just, I get to view like my limited little timeline of it, you know, but, you know, we started in the 90s, and then you had Tiger, which was, he was everything for 15 years, 20 years. And then, I mean, he's still, you could say, everything in terms of the perception of outsiders of the game of golf. Tiger is still like what people move, you know, care about the most. But anyways, as he's moved on in years, I feel like the emergence of social media, you know, all the different, the Golfer's Journal that I know you are a contributor to, and Tom Coyne's a good friend, and there's been a resurgence of literature and art around it. The resurgence of minimalist architecture courses that are handmade, that are, you know, made with just a different ethos, a different artistry than, you know, what was going on from, boy, you could probably say from the 50s all the way through to the 90s, you know, when everything was being made with a steam shovel. And now there's like, you know, what it feels, it is, it's rewarding to me, because one of the adjectives that's been used about my work in golf from the very beginning is authentic. And, fortunately for me, authenticity has sort of come into vogue. You know, a lot of people are looking for that real human experience and that real, you know, the ragged edges of things, not just the sort of, you know, wall to wall perfection of you know, the golf experience of 1992 when, you know, Greg Norman was king of the world.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a different environment, you know, top to bottom. I think that's a great point about, you know, the resurgence in authenticity. I think nowadays, you know, people, they can smell the BS pretty quickly, right? They can smell something that's forced, and they tend to just kind of keep trotting on by it for the most part. At least I think the number of people, particularly golfers, growing exponentially. People who are looking for the realness out there. And it's funny to me too, because I think about the world of golf architects, and you know, which we both obviously enjoy. I think there's just this massive opportunity brewing where, you know, what's going to happen in the next 20 years is going to be a reimagining of a lot of places that were built without a lot of imagination to begin with. I'm not sure we're going to be able to have massive new landscapes continue to be, you know, with dirt turning over, but there's a lot of landscapes that already have been, worked over and probably are in dire need of something very, very different to rescue them from the mundane. But so it'll be interesting to see how that works. But, you know, this last year has been probably, I imagine, a pretty busy one for you, even, you know, with COVID and everything. You know, we had 7 majors and, you know, however many months that was a bit of a whirlwind. How was that for you?
It was a wild ride, that's for sure. And actually one of the areas in our business that boomed during COVID was the logo and branding business, which, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I conclude that, you know, as we all know, more and more people are on the golf course in the last 18 months than had been for, you know, it had been declining for steadily for years, golf participation, and all of a sudden it exploded again. And as a result, a lot of these members are now, spending a lot more time at their club. And I mean, it's not just private clubs, but that's the lion's share of our business. Yeah. And you have these members, and I feel like there was a, there was just a renewed, like people were spending more time there and they were realizing, oh, this could be a little better, or we could spruce this up a little bit, you know, and it was becoming more important. They're taking less for granted, I think, because they were just there more often, a few times a week instead of once every couple or something like that. So there was that. And then again, the social media, like the logo side of golf, it was always there, you know. I mean, even way back when, there were golf logos that you just wanted to have because they were cool, because, you know, the course was what it was. Yeah. So there's always been this sort of cult fetish around cool logos in golf, but you know, social media has just thrown gas on that fire, and then in a way, to your point, for as many clubs as there are, many courses as there are out there, that, you know, maybe they've been around for 80 years, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily anything great and couldn't use a complete turnover of dirt and ground and design. One of the things we've done a lot of in the last year is rebrand clubs. I mean, at one point we had 5 different clients, all private clubs that were 100 years old or older. And, you know, that's a pretty unique cross-section of clientele to have. And it's a unique challenge to rebrand a club that's 100 or 125 years old, because there's so much history there, and there's just, people have so much skin in the game. There's so much life that's been lived in a club of that vintage. So to try to put a brand on something, that's that far, that's that far into the game is a unique challenge, but it's been a lot of fun. And the last point I wanted to make about that is the reason we're doing this kind of work is, you know, for example, I'll bring up, we just recreated a merchandising mark for Wilmington Country Club in Wilmington, Delaware, 36-hole facility, phenomenal facility built on a former DuPont estate. So we created a new brand for merchandising there because their original and still existing mark is one of the fairly, I don't want to say generic, but because that's a little bit overstating, but it's a common motif in old golf is the championship belt, which often ends up looking a bit like a lifesaver or something like that. But usually it's based on the belt that was like the championship belt that Tom Morris Jr. won, you know, in 1865 or whatever.
Yeah, Crystal Dowd has a belt in their logo.
Yeah, I mean, it's a motif, and it's just like a shield. It's a motif that you see in many, many different clubs of that vintage. And it's because, you know, the logo wasn't a thing. It wasn't something, it didn't have a job to do back in 1909, the way the logo for a golf club has a job to do now. So you have a lot of these clubs that have these marks, and they have their place. They're, you know, they have their tenure, so to speak. They've been there from the beginning in many occasions. But that doesn't mean that they're serving the club well in terms of being a visual ambassador for the club, or even as simply put as moving shirts and hats, you know?
Yep.
You want a mark, you know, would you rather, this is part of my sales pitch, would you rather be a club with an excellent golf facility or operation that has, you know, a competent logo, or would you rather be a club that had a great golf course that had a really fun and appealing logo that people like to buy, you know?
Yeah.
We've done a lot of work for clubs that move from something that, you know, sometimes they're making a complete move, meaning they're leaving the past behind, like Weburn, you know, they've left behind what they had before and moved into a brand new brand, which has been doing very, very well. And one of the projects I'm clearly very proud of because of the company that that club keeps in that section. But in other cases, such as Wilmington, we're doing some work right now at Greensboro. Anyways, other clubs where the existing mark is going to be retained on club stationery and whatnot, but we're creating something else that's going to, you know, live on apparel and shirts and things like that, and in the golf ops section of things, you know. So the places that people see it the most, the touch points, you know, we want those touch points to be exciting and fun and interesting whenever possible. So I feel like sort of the confluence of social media, a resurgence in participation, and I don't know, this trend towards authenticity, as you mentioned, have sort of come together in a nice way, and they've served to certainly keep us really busy.
You know, it's funny. I do a lot of branding work, you know, with a lot of local clients here in Tallahassee, and I always tell them, you know, your brand is the story that people tell about you, right? And when you think about a really powerful logo for a club, you know, you want that to be obviously recognizable, but you also want it to be something that is inspired and that is married to either a you know, one large story or elements of a story, right? And the thing that's so unique, I think you touched on this, you know, if you walk into a pro shop today, I think you know, my generation certainly feels this way. Why do you have to limit to only one mark? You know, why can't I walk in and get four or five versions of the story, right? You know, because different things about places speak to people in different ways. And you know, you probably want to have, you know, something that's sort of the central main you know, main theme, but you know, I've seen numerous places that are coming up with a variety of marks that, you know, fit the different personas of a club, which I think is really, really cool to see that, you know?
I feel like that's almost like, I don't even know the right word anymore. And, you know, I used to say a postmodern approach. Now it's like a millennial approach, or I don't know what you want to say, but, you know, one of the best examples of that, I feel, is Sweetens Cove. I
was talking
a year or so ago, and, you know, they've got a million marks running through there, and it sort of defies conventional wisdom. You know, I mean, you only see the Golden Arches in gold. I mean, you only see the Coke in red and white. I mean, it's, you know, that consistency of messaging has been like a cornerstone of branding for, you know, a century. And now, you know, it's because of the different commerce platforms, I think, that are at play now. You know, when you think of the fact that there's an internet economy just in the world of golf logoed merchandise right now, I mean, that literally didn't exist 20 years ago. I mean, it's just poofed, materialized out of, you know, the ethernet. You know, suddenly, like, the rules are all different. And, you know, it's a lot to manage. I don't feel like that's for everybody to have, like, you know, you got to be a kind of a hipster operation, I feel like, to be able to churn out one mark after another and have, you know, appealing to your core market, to your core customer clientele. You know, I think most members clubs and things like that are going to have a little bit more of a, you know, narrow approach than Sweetens Cove. It is interesting how, you know, the wheel can be reinvented a little bit these days.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. So, you know, what are the things that that you're working on next? What's coming down? You know, we talked about Tim Aquan, obviously, but what are the other things that are sort of on your pipeline that's got you excited for, yeah, the weeks and months and years ahead?
Well, the most immediate thing is we're trying to keep up or stay ahead of the curve of things right now. We're actually going to be launching an NFT offering next week. We're dipping our toe in the water with that arena. We're I have done the, I did a number of golf abstractions a few years ago, which are highly textured abstract paintings on panels inspired by iconic architectural elements from golf courses in the United States. So for example, one of the holes that's, I wouldn't say that they're depicted, they're more like the hole serve as sort of the inspiration for the composition.
Yeah.
So, you know, the 11th at Marion, which is where you probably know Bob Jones concluded and wrapped up the Grand Slam in 1930. The 17th at Pebble Beach, which is one of my very favorite holes. I feel like that's, I don't know if you can call it a sleeper at Pebble, but man, the 17th is, I mean, it's so beautiful and so hard and so crazy. So there's a really neat, I mean, when you look at that green and those bunkers from above, it looks like a Miro painting. So
yeah,
we kind of took these interesting and historically significant golf holes or golf features and made them into fun abstractions. And we're offering these as NFTs next week. First time doing that. We're going to be doing one as a set of four, NFT only. And then the church pew bunkers at Oakmont, we're offering the physical original and the NFT together as a package. So we're going to be starting active promotion next, the end of this week, I guess. Next week, the auction will go up on OpenSea. So that's kind of a little bit of a Pandora's box. You know, I really don't know. Like, I certainly feel like I've gotten our business to where we are today by taking a swing at things every now and then. You know, you really always have to force yourself. And maybe this is the artistic more than the business side of things, but I just feel like to remain interested in what I'm doing, I need to get out of the box. I need to stretch out of the comfort zone. I need to try new things. And lots of times you want to try things that might have a big upside, you know, like, you know, just to see.
Yeah.
So this is going to be, you know, we're very excited about it. It could be, you know, something fairly pedestrian, or it could be an interesting development. So that's coming up. I mean, we timed it so it's right on the heels of our last major. It's been a great season of majors, you know, for us as a business, as well as for all of us as fans. Couldn't have a better lineup of winners this year. I mean, it's pretty, pretty unbelievable. So the NFT is a little something that we're rolling out next. And then sort of we'll be moving into Ryder Cup mode after that. Looking forward with bated breath and crossed fingers to a full field, you know, full attendance event, which is what's expected and planned in Wisconsin in September. And, you know, I'm someone who typically works all these events every year. So I kind of didn't mind a reprieve for a little while, but I'm ready to go where the action is again. And, you know, there's no more fiery environment in golf than the Ryder Cup. So we'll be heading there later in September, and just a ton of things going on otherwise, from Senior Open and US Open posters are in development stages for next year. So I was up at the country club shooting and doing what I do up at Brookline back in May. And, you know, that's one of those places that, you know, I feel like you grew up in the game, so you probably have an even greater appreciation. But, you know, doing the U.S. Open at Brookline for someone who does what I do, I mean, I get goosebumps just talking about it. I can't wait for that event. It's going to be really, really special. And that golf course, New England golf, is so interesting and so different than anywhere else. I mean, those rock outcroppings, and there's just a ruggedness to the courses in New England that's artistically very compelling. So between the history, the visuals of the golf course, and of course the national championship, I mean, it's going to be a great marriage. I'm super excited about that. The painting that's the biggest in the studio right now sesquicentennial, is that right?
Yeah.
125th anniversary for Essex Fells Country Club in northern New Jersey, not too far from New York City. A really neat course that's sort of been, you know, an amalgamation of some great names over the years. It's not one of those sort of thoroughbreds or pure breeds that, you know, you see a lot of.
Been
a lot of hands in there, and it's got a really neat history, and it's a neat spot. So the head pro there, director of golf, general manager, Dan Pasternak, is a really good friend. I think he's a Strasbourg winner for the PGA a few years ago. So he's just a great dude. Yeah, off the top of my head, there's a few. I mean, right now we're putting finishing touches on a non-golf project. We are creating the artwork for the fall meet at Keeneland. We do the spring and fall races at Keeneland every year, the home of Thoroughbred Racing in Lexington. So that's a really neat thing. And I'm also working.
Do they just pay you in bourbon, or how does that?
That would be all right. But no, unfortunately, they pay in cash. Can't say that too often.
Yeah.
And then a little tennis work. We're actually working for the Rolex Monte Carlo Masters. Always try and sort of plant some flags outside of golf. I think there's a lot of obvious extensions into other arenas in terms of lifestyle from golf and horses and tennis and yachting and things like that. I think are always things that have captivated my imagination. So we're happy for these opportunities with Keeneland and Rolex. And did a little NBA project a few years ago, the NBA All-Star game a couple of years ago. So it's always fun to sort of get out of the thing you do every day and into some other arenas as well.
That's cool. You know, I hadn't really thought about other potential areas, but have you ever done any work with, communities or cities? I've spent a lot of time in my career, sort of in the placemaking world and, trying to tell stories on behalf of communities. But like, I'll give you an example. So Tallahassee will turn 200 years old in 2024. And I just wrote a column, in our local paper the other day about, we've always sort of struggled to tell our story in a compelling fashion. And what I was telling them, everybody was, I think the struggle has been is everybody's always tried to find that one silver bullet that represents everything. And right. Kind of like maybe the club you refer to, we got 200 years worth of amalgamation of stories. So it's very hard to find one thing, but perhaps there is a canvas that we could paint that, tells a lot of those things. So that might be something worth, we should have a conversation sidebar on later, but there's some opportunity there. I continue to find a lot of similarities between, cities that really do a great job telling their story and golf destinations that do a great job telling their story.
Interesting.
They mirror each other a lot more than you might
expect. That makes sense to me. I'd not thought about it before, but that makes sense. In fact, well, now that you mentioned that, I am one of the other things I was just looking at this morning as well. I mean, it's so cool to be at a point in a career where, we've got probably 6 or 7 different pictures in the works at any given moment, Yeah. And most of them are going to be painted by me at some point, but we do a lot of the development, the sketching, the modifications and edits, digitally because it's so expedient. So,
yeah.
I've got a really talented staff and we always have things at various stages of development. Hmm. So I'm a native Philadelphian and I moved out to Flagstaff, Arizona 11 years ago. And it's a majestic place with a lot of very interesting history. And I'll just mention a few couple of quick things. So we're built on the side of an extinct volcano that rises to almost 13,000 feet right behind town. So it's the highest point in Arizona. And it's not a mountain, it's a mountain unlike any other mountain I've seen in the sense that it's not a range, like it's an island.
Yeah.
Literally a green pointed island in the middle of this desert that slopes downward in every direction, 360 degrees. So it has this unique presence. It's all high country, like high desert ponderosa pine. The train is huge here. The train comes through downtown Flag, like a block from my studio, 100 times a day, we get trains coming through here, carrying, the commerce of the country back and forth. Route 66 runs right through town. My parents for their honeymoon in the early 60s, hopped into my dad's convertible and drove across country on Route 66. I've got pictures of my parents with my brother as a one-year-old from Flagstaff in, 65 or something like that. So anyways, it's a place that I felt like it was completely new, but somehow I felt this connection to. And I've always wanted to do artwork based on Northern Arizona because everybody thinks the same things about Arizona that I thought before I got here, which is, you know, saguaro cactus and the, you know, Phoenix, heat, sun, brown, you know, that kind of thing. And up here, it's just a completely different animal. So we're, Sedona's 35 minutes away. So you've got these red rocks that look like Utah, you know, right down the road. One of my favorite, one of my very favorite golf courses in the whole northern half of the state, Oak Creek Country Club, is a classic RTJ senior golf course, like laid out in the flatness up against the red buttes. You know, kind of the way Cherry Hills is surprisingly flat, considering it's right against the Rockies, but it's this flat, walkable, classic track that's like you're playing through these red rock canyons. So there's that. And then, so you got, and then you got the Grand Canyon an hour the other direction. So I've been wanting to do art about Northern Arizona for years. And we just started working on the first one this summer. We're going to launch a series of six different images that are going to be celebrating different aspects of, you know, the geography, the topography, as well as sort of the cultural history of Northern Arizona. So in answer to your question, you could have asked me this time 6 months ago and I had to say no, but for the very first time, we're kind of doing some very location specific work. And I like what you say about that. I do think that cities, especially, I feel like, again, trends in terms of what's happening these days, trends towards smaller cities that are livable, that are, you know, are interesting, that are, you know, affordable, basically, you know, because top 10 cities in the country are out of pocket for most people. So, you know, I feel like the cities that are shining these days tell their stories very well.
Oh, absolutely. It's a real differentiator, in my opinion, you know, whether or not someone takes the time and puts the energy and effort into, you know, telling a compelling story about, you know, who they are. Otherwise, you know, just another stop on the truck route, so to speak. Yeah, that's cool. I'll look forward to seeing that Arizona work. That sounds neat. I've never been to Arizona, but one of my very close friends was out there a few months ago and did kind of a pretty significant bounce around, went up to Sedona and just said it was just incredible. Loved every second.
Obviously, it's a different kind of golf than I feel like, you know, you know, there's so much sort of in the Northeast or in the East in general, and Chicago and other places, you know, LA, San Francisco, there's like these, you know, the places that have an 80 or 100 or more year old history with the game, there's sort of a different ethos at play, I feel like, than what you have in like Arizona, you know, where everything feels a lot newer. But that said, you know, the range of golf here is really, really interesting. Forest Highlands, Flagstaff has a small number of courses and clubs. I mean, it's a small city. So, and water is at a premium here, as you would expect. But, you know, Marsh and Weisskopf have a little bit of a monopoly up here. And you know, I was excited to move out here for one reason years ago, just because Forest Highlands was on Tom Doak's Gourmet 31 Choices in my copy of his book a million years ago, you know. So Forest Highlands was certainly the first place I played when I got out here. And, you know, it's awfully nice when the ball goes as far as it goes at 7,000 feet.
Yeah, no doubt. That helps. And my brother lives out in Denver, and I think he's gotten pretty spoiled at hitting the ball, you know.
It's hard to play at sea level again. Yeah, man.
He gets back down here in, you know, muggy Florida heat again, and sees his, you know, older brother blowing it by him, and he can't figure out what's going on. But it's fun. So do you get back to the Philly area much these days, or, you know, other than just when Tom comes calling?
Well, certainly a couple times a year in normal times, we get back there for family reasons, sometimes more for professional reasons. We were back there in May for an extended stint, seeing my folks and my family, whom we hadn't seen for well over a year because of the COVID deal. So we spent some extra time visiting family, and that was great. And then also working on a little project with Tom and Gil Hans as well. So in a very short period of time, we visited a number of spectacular places. So I was painting or shooting at Tom's event at Rolling Green, which was pretty awesome. That place handed everyone their hat that day, boy. There were a lot of people walking off the 18th like they got punched in the face. But we were also out at Marion and Philadelphia Country and Saucon Valley and Aronimink and Philly Cricket that week. So got a really, really good crash course in Philly golf. I mean, that's like backtracking a little, being a Philadelphian and then getting into golf. I mean, from talking with Tom and Gil that week, it even reinforced my already biased attitude that there's no place like Philly. I mean, you could argue that Chicago and Wingfoot, or I'm sorry, Chicago and New York are just as good golf cities. But what I would say is that who learned their trade in Philadelphia and then went on around the world? Like Flynn and Tillinghast, Wilson, George Thomas. I mean, just look at Tillinghast and Thomas and Flynn. Yep. Those, they all either were Philadelphians or born and raised or learned their craft in Philadelphia and then built the greatest golf courses in the country, all around the country. So
even Dick Wilson, Dick Wilson.
New Yorkers in that mix.
Their pedigree as far as, you know, it's certainly the cradle of American golf architecture for Americans.
Yeah.
Like that first generation of Americans who were building golf courses, you know, I take Ross and, you know, some of our, you know, that immigrated here out, but no question. I mean, that was the real impetus for so many designs all over the country. I always tell, you know, I've only been to Philly once and we were up there for a wedding and we got out in the countryside a little bit where this beautiful wedding was. It was at a, some home that dated back to the Revolutionary era. And right across the street was this golf course. And I just remember thinking, like, I had so much regret because I kind of didn't bring my club. And it was beautiful. And I remember thinking, I was like, you know, the terrain there, for whatever reason, reminds me of the terrain here in Tallahassee. You know, so we were talking about Florida and Tim Aquana, you know, mostly dead flat. But Tallahassee's got the last, like, little finger of the, you know, the ancient Appalachians.
Nice.
The weaves all the way through here. And our course has just got this unbelievable topography. I mean, it really rolls out here. And I saw some of the photos from Rolling Green, particularly some of the work that had been done there and some of the tree removal. And we're going through our own program of that right now. And every time we take out, you know, a lot of that brush and just clutter, you know, that suffocates golf holes, I see more and more of that, you know, look that you now see in places like Rolling Green. Anyway, I've always thought that there's a odd similarity. And the funny thing is Tillinghast actually came here and designed our back nine. So there's a
oh problem. Wow.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So anyway, so you'll be hitting the road again soon, sounds like, going off to the Ryder Cup and hawking some stuff up there. Those are pretty busy weeks for you, I would imagine.
Yeah. You know, they range in experience depending on the weather and lots of other factors. But typically they're busy weeks. I mean, the US Open is usually my longest gig, in terms of the stint. I'll typically be at the championship for about 10 days for US Open. Some of the others, you know, less than half of that. It's, you know, typically very busy. As often as not these days, I'll paint a little bit out on the course each day, just for fun and for social media. And then I'll spend, you know, the majority of the time in the merchandise pavilion, signing posters for folks and that sort of thing. So it's a nice little mix. It's fun to be at the center of the universe, for a few days too. You know, I always enjoy that feeling, you know, in our world, during a major, you know, everybody's there or wants to be there. And, it's, you know, it's a tough spectator sport, golf, you know. I mean, as we all know, it's a little bit easier on TV when you can see a lot more golf than you can, you know, on your own 2 feet on the ground there. Yeah. But there is a visceral, palpable, you know, buzz that you get from being, you know, at a major championship that, you know, you definitely miss it after a year and a half or almost two of being away from it. I'm excited to jump back in the mix and just, you know, enjoy the show.
Yeah, well, I'm excited for you. I'll be watching from home. We got I'll have my second child born here sometime in the next few weeks. The doc told my wife to go ahead and pack the bag, so we're gaining on that. But I'll be jealous of everyone up in Wisconsin, and hope to hit the road for a few of these things maybe next year.
That'd be great. We'll have to meet up at one of these places. That'd be fun.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, if you make it over to Jim and Friends, or next trip you make to Temequana, shoot me a note. I'd love to get
just
over
across,
there.
Just across, right? What is that?
Oh, yeah. We're 2 hours. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we get over there. We do a lot of day tripping to the Quan from over here in Tallahassee.
I just did a picture of what I think my first painting this year was Palmasia.
Oh, yeah.
Down the coast from you, right? I mean, that's a really neat spot. Bobby Weed's a good friend of mine also.
Oh, yeah.
I first played Temequana with Bobby probably 20 years ago. Sorry,
yeah,
that's
he was working out there.
COVID puppy dog making her appearance. But anyways, yeah, Palmasia was a neat project. And in fact, part of that, one of the things that I wanted to do around that was I also wanted to try and find a way to get the job doing a poster for the Gasparilla parade. I just thought that'd be a really, really fun thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my wish list jobs. That's not complicated.
I love it. Well, I think you're on something there. Right? There, you probably could do a lot more of that, municipal branded type type work. So we'll have to see if
we can Tallahassee ever needs a poster to promote, or some visual messaging. Give us a ring.
Yeah, we need
get
to do
down
that.
There even sooner.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, hey man, thanks for your time. This has been a tremendous conversation. I've enjoyed the chance to, always been a big fan of your work, and I'm glad we were able to connect and spend a little time getting to know each other a little better. So we'll definitely have to try to get together on the golf course here before too long.
That sounds great. I really enjoyed it, Jay. Thanks for the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. Same to you. And take good care, and we'll see you down the road somewhere.
All right, man. Keep swinging. Take
all
it
right,
easy.
You too, pal. Be good.